Hey, you guys, the Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this show, more than 500 and counting, are available for free. Everything is free. You can listen to all of it for free. There is an Other People app. That, too, is free. It's all free. Your support makes a difference. If you would like to support this program, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. Thanks.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jeez, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person at just
Hello,
one
everybody.
Time.
Hi, right. How's it going? Right. This is the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. It's nice to be with you. It's nice to have Laura Vandenberg back on this program. She is celebrating the publication of a new novel called The Third Hotel. It's available now from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. I am not alone in believing that she's one of the best fiction writers alive right now. Like, no hyperbole. I really believe that. And I'm not the only one. There are a lot of us out there that think that she has like a real gift and is really doing the work at a high level. So it's really great to get the chance to talk with her about the new book, about her life, her writing life, and about the state of things. So that conversation with Laura Vandenberg is coming up. Speaking of the state of things, I'm recording this once again on a Saturday. That seems to be the way that I'm able to do this now. In light of, job obligations and everything else, I tend to be recording on Saturday. So taking into account that today is Saturday, October the 6th, 2018, and everything that entails in terms of what's going on in the United States of America. So if you hear like fatigue in my voice or like a beleaguered tone, I hope you'll take into account historical context. I'm flagging this monologue for posterity. Just look up what happened. At this particular moment in history on Wikipedia, you'll know why my voice sounds like this. But, you know, I also had it was like a long week, busy week. I got home late last night. I was tired. I was trying to, you know, process everything. So I took I take like 2 milligrams of cannabis, like a very, very small dose. I'm trying to like hit some sort of sweet spot where I'm, you know, it's like very slightly psychoactive, but not a problem. You know, I can control my narrative. Like, I just want to like take the edge off a little bit. Like, you know how it is. It's been quite a week and there's just a lot going on. I needed to just have a moment. So I was just trying to like relax, watch TV, but I didn't want to watch the news because of course that's not relaxing. So I start flipping through like HBO. I think it was HBO, and I find that Titanic is on. It's like on HBO. So I start watching Titanic, and really enjoyed it. Like, found myself being like, "This is fantastic." And I think part of that was the edible, but then part of it was just me trying to reconcile how bad the dialogue is in that movie with how popular the movie is and how much I was enjoying it. Like, the appeal is odd, is what I'm trying to get at. And then it was also, I think this, the storyline of the movie Titanic has this kind of, it's about class. It's about social class. You know, the people in steerage drown while the rich people get the lifeboats. And you know what I'm saying? It's pretty like overt, but it felt to me last night, in a state of like cannabinoid fatigue, like profound. And then it was also me understanding that the appeal of the movie is in large part contingent on the performance of Kate Winslet in particular, but also Leo. I really feel like Kate Winslet is the reason the movie goes, because her character is the most interesting. But there's just, Kate is a very talented actor. Leo's very talented. They're both very beautiful. And they're like in I tweeted about it. It's like the gaudy beauty of youth, you know, where you're just like young and perfectly beautiful. and then they're lit to sort of accentuate that. They're on like the, you know, they're on the boat and the sun's going down. I was just like so into it. And I was like, oh, and they're doomed. I don't even know if I have a point other than to tell you that I watched Titanic while slightly baked at the end of the week. And at the end of this latest, like, terrible cycle of Supreme Court bullshit that did not end well. And you know what? I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. I think we've all had enough. For those of us who give a shit, we've all spent plenty of time contemplating it and talking about it. But all I can tell you is that, you know, taking like, you know, 2 milligrams of cannabis or whatever and watching Titanic makes things slightly better. And the Celine Dion soundtrack too. There's something just undeniable about it. That song. And I was like texting with my friend. I think I actually cribbed this for a tweet. Like, I should have given him credit for it, but I was like, yeah, like, I feel like this movie is, you know, it's telling me where we are right now. It's explaining America to me right now. And he was like, yeah, you know, basically we're at, you know, if Titanic is America in 2018, we're now like at the part of the movie where Billy Zane has a gun and is like chasing Leo, like all around the boat, trying to shoot him.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, anyway, Laura Vandenberg was here. She came over to my house and she sat down with me. We had a conversation and it was great. So fun to see her in person and to get a chance to share that conversation with you guys. Her new novel is called The Third Hotel. It's out there now from FSG. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Laura Vandenberg.
I started boxing last year but only really got serious, I would say, this winter.
Why? Why did you get into boxing?
Sort of on accident. I was just in like a difficult headspace. I think I was having, I turned in, you know, my book and I had done Third Hotel, the one that just came out, and I had done copy edits and all that stuff. And so I was having a little bit of book postpartum. There was some illness in my family that had been pretty tough. And
you're ready to kick some ass.
Yeah. And also the world's on fire.
Yeah.
Which, by the way,
that stress is not to be.
Yeah.
Not, you know, it's not nothing.
No, it's not nothing. So all of those things kind of colliding, I was like, I need to find a new dimension in my life for sort of processing this. And so I got a class pass and just thought, you know, okay, I'll just.
Did somebody recommend this to you?
No, I knew people who had boxed. I mean, it was not completely, you know, it was not completely like alien to me, but I had not ever, I mean, I'd taken sort of cardio boxing classes, but that's not,
this is like,
really
you put
counting.
On like, did you put on like protective headgear?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm like just working up to light sparring. So it takes you, you know, if you've never boxed before, it's going to take you a while probably to get there. So I did a class pass and I would go to like, you know, I was like, everyone says that yoga is supposed to help with anxiety. Which for me, it doesn't. I'm probably doing it wrong, but it's like the idea that you're supposed to kind of empty your mind and that's supposed to calm you down. For me, it's just, it creates this like blank space in which it, into which like anxiety can flood. So I just took a boxing class just in the interest of like trying something different. It was one of the physically hardest things that I'd ever done. I thought
it's a good workout.
It's a really good workout. And like, I run with my dog. I thought it was in pretty decent shape. is that it is a completely like next level kind of fitness. And so it was really hard. I didn't know how to do anything. I didn't know how to wrap my hands. I didn't know how to jab. This very good teacher who just like was really good about kind of breaking it down, very, really good about the kind of technicalities of form. And I was immediately, hooked. And so I started coming back and coming back. And then this winter into the spring, I was going like 5 mornings a week and getting up early to go and start
million
working.
Dollar baby.
Yeah, one-on-one with someone. And it was so sad. It was, I've been on kind of like hiatus because I've been traveling a lot this summer and have been on book tour, but it was so, satisfying to learn. And it's all craft, you know, I mean, I think there's so much synergy between boxing and writing, and so many writers have written about boxing. And yeah, I mean, it's all craft.
Have you ever read FX Tool? Isn't that somebody who's
no,
like,
I'm reading Catherine Dunn's essays on boxing now, but I haven't read that one.
I want to say, I'm just like pulling like for boxing fiction, yeah, or something, but like boxing writing.
Yeah. And Joyce Killer Oates has written a nonfiction book about boxing.
She's written a book about everything.
She has. That's true. I guess. Yeah. She's like really covered, the gamut. Katie Kitamura has a really great novel about, mixed martial arts, not just, boxing, but about fighting. And yeah, so there's a kind of whole canon of like fighting literature.
So, but what's the synergy between boxing and writing? Just the discipline, the craft?
For sure. I think that, I mean, certainly the craft, you know, and I think in one, like when you read a great scene in fiction, there's this sense that it's doing one thing, but of course it's doing like 15 different things simultaneously. And even if you're tracking one line of movement, you can sense those other elements working on you as you're reading, right? And I think boxing is actually very similar. If you watch a professional fighter in a ring and they do this like one movement and it's so elegant and it's so powerful, but it's actually made up of these kind of 15, you know, micro movements that they have, it's a language they've internalized. And so they do it, they're doing it, you know, unconsciously and instinctively to some degree. And I think that that's true for writing. It's like our own sort of style and sensibility becomes this internalized language that we then, you know, give shape to on the page. So I feel like there's so much with a kind of practice of craft with the aim of it being something you know but don't necessarily actively think about, or don't think about like it, like each step. That to me feels like very conversant with writing.
Yeah. You should write about boxing. Now I want you ringside.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe one day. That would be so cool. I feel like I need, but there's also so much, there's an endless amount, also like writing. I mean, there's an endless amount of, there's an endless amount of stuff to learn about boxing. I mean, it is such a complex, I mean, both like the culture of it, the technical aspect, different styles and sort of philosophies of training and of fighting. I mean, it's such a complex sport that some people have actually asked me, because I tweet about boxing, Instagram about boxing a fair amount, if I would write something about it. And you know, I feel like I need to know more about it. I would want to, yeah, be writing from a place of like deeper knowledge than I feel like I have right now.
Well, it sounds like you're on your way.
I'm working. Yeah, I'm working my way there.
Have you sparred with somebody yet?
Yeah, I have sparred, which was terrifying.
I was going to say, because I want to ask you about fear. Like, it's one thing to train and to like work on the heavy bag and like the speed bag or whatever you call it. Is that what you call it?
Yeah.
Okay, so that stuff I get. And then like also just all the cardio and like doing the cool jump roping and stuff.
But yeah,
then you get into the ring and there's somebody coming at you to like hit you in the face. Like that's where I'm like, you know what? I don't want to.
Yeah, you're like, I'm all set.
I'm out.
Yeah. But. Yeah. I mean, the sparring that I've done was sort of, it was like light sparring. So it was, you know, you're not hitting, you're hitting with maybe like 40%, which still doesn't feel great if you get hit in the face at 40%, but it's, you know, it's not like you really are in the ring to train each other and to practice things that have been sort of theoretical on like the heavy bag, for example, or footwork drills, to actually, you know, do them in there, do that sort of work in the intended context. And it is intimidating. And I'm new enough to even light sparring that, you know, my stomach does sort of like lurch, when the round begins. But I think one of the things that I love about boxing, which again, I think is sort of very much like writing when you're really in a groove with a piece of work, is that it feels like a sober way to exist outside time. just to say, when you're in the ring with someone, like, there is no space to think about anything else.
Right.
And if your attention drifts even for like a second, you will pay for it. So it's this great lesson in just focus and kind of being hyper present.
That's what the yoga teachers are trying to get you to.
Yeah.
But you're like, no, I want it in the ring.
Yeah. I was like, I'm a Gemini.
Hey,
I like to, Geminis aren't great at being. Being still always, but
I don't think anybody is.
You're right, and that's like a discipline and a practice that you build. And I probably didn't stay in it long enough.
But. Yeah, but it's like, you know, but you seems like you're getting it in the ring. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah, it's that right. This has become, fighting is definitely like a meditative practice for me in some ways.
Are you aggressive? You don't seem like, you don't strike me as somebody like, I wouldn't look at you and be like boxer. But you know, sometimes people are you somebody who. Like if you're playing Monopoly, like you're competitive and you got to win, like do you have that kind of thing going on?
No, not really. I don't think I'm super competitive with other people. And I haven't really played sports before. So I was never like on, I don't know, like a high school soccer team or something like that. So, I mean, I guess I don't really know for sure because I don't have a lot of experience. But even right with the board game analogy, and there are totally people in my family that are like ultra competitive and will get like really upset if they're, you know, losing in a game of Monopoly or chess or something. But yeah, that's not really been my MO. I mean, I think I'm sort of self-competitive where I'm always looking at like where I am and how can I kind of raise the bar on myself. So I do feel like I'm competitive or ambitious in that way, but not usually super competitive with other people.
Like raise the bar in terms of like your personal conduct, or is it like more of like raise the bar like creatively and professionally? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, or is it all of the above?
All of the above. Absolutely.
You're hard on yourself.
I'm going to do all things better all the time.
Yeah. I can kind of be that way with myself too. Like I'm always tinkering and I can drift into guilt pretty easily. Like I'm not doing enough. You know, this is my fault. Do you get into that mindset?
Yeah, for sure. What's your sign?
Leo.
Mm.
I'm a Leo, but whenever people who like have spent time around me, I'm one of those people who I'm like, I'm a Leo. And they're like, really?
What's your rising sign?
I don't know. I don't know anything about all that.
Okay.
I was just emailing with Karolina Butslaviak, who knows a lot about this stuff.
Yeah.
And she asked me to send my birthday and the time of birth. Hang on. Let me see if I can find this. And I know that I was born at 9:09. Does that make anything different? I don't know. But like, you know, I sent her that stuff and I was supposed to get some sort of, report back on who I am.
Well, that's sort of a terrifying phrase, a report back on who I am.
But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying. I have solicited those reports for myself at different moments in time. Yeah, I mean, I asked about your rising sign because I think some people are more like their rising sign, or their front kind of facing self is more like their rising sign than their main sign. So I'm a Gemini rising. My rising sign is Cancer, but I think I'm like uber Gemini in a lot of ways, and feel less like a Cancer, but I can also see, you know.
So, okay. I'm looking at I have my report.
Okay. What's the verdict?
It says planetary positions, Sun, Leo in house 11, direct, Moon, Taurus in house 9, direct. Like, how do I know what my rising sign is?
I think your rising sign is your sun sign.
So I'm a Leo sun sign too. I'm a double Leo.
So you're double Leo?
What does that mean? I feel like Leos are sort of assholes. It's like, oh, we're...
No,
they're always like, you're vain and you're the lion. You know what I'm saying?
That's not true. I mean, my dog's a Leo and actually, I do think my dog's pretty vain for a dog.
I will say this. My sisters,
looks like a lion.
My sisters are both... Leos. They're born on the same day, 7 days apart, August 18th. I'm August 1st. And I think my older sister and I both have this where, like, if we pass a mirror, we will look at ourselves.
Yeah.
Like, I'll always be like, oh, that's me. Like, part of it's just like, whoa, I'm a person, you know?
Yeah.
But it's also like, oh, do I look okay? Like, I do have that. Maybe that's vanity.
I mean, I think attention to sort of like exteriors and aesthetics isn't necessary. Like, it's not inherently a bad thing, right? As long as it doesn't become so dominant that it usurps everything else.
Well, I also sometimes argue that vanity is actually, it gets a bad rap.
Yeah.
Like you can overdo it, but I think caring about how you look a little bit is a good thing.
Well, yeah, or sort of like, I mean, you know, and I mean, there's a lot that's bound up if we just are thinking about sort of like cultivation of personal style. You know what I mean? There can be, you know, yes, and it can be sort of superficial, but also like there can be something really powerful about cultivating personal style that you feel at home in, that it becomes a source of kind of like, you know, it armors you up to move through the world, or perhaps it feels like a creative expression. So I think sometimes those, you know, those quote unquote superficial elements contain more meaning than we might give them credit for.
Yeah. Actually. And also just like self-care, you know, like, yeah. Like watching out for like what you eat and how you drink. And I don't know, like that sort of stuff seems good to me. Like how you can overdo it, of course.
Yeah, but. Of course. Well, most things can become toxic if taken to their most extreme, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So vanity a little bit is okay.
Yeah. I think a little vanity is okay.
I want to talk to you about Havana.
Okay.
That's where your novel is set.
Yes.
You had to have gone there.
I did. I took 3 research trips.
Okay. And you can go there now as an American.
You can. Yeah. I mean, I went on a research visa, which is actually very straightforward and very easy. It's a little bit more complicated now, but the short answer is yes.
Okay. So why did you get it in your head? Did you know, like, I want to set a book there, or you're just like, I want to go there and check it out, or?
Yeah. So, this is going to be a long answer just to prepare you.
Yeah.
Because there are multiple, there are intersecting reasons. So so the third hotel is about a couple, Claire and Richard. Richard is a horror film scholar, which is my secret dream job.
Horror
film. Film scholar.
Yeah.
Like scary, yeah, scary movies. And he is killed in a hit-and-run car accident under mysterious circumstances and had plans at the time of his death to go to a film festival in Havana, and Claire ends up going in his place. So that's the kind of the context. But it's my practice when I'm between projects to keep a thought log, which is just exactly what it sounds like, a notebook where I record thoughts. So I was writing...
Okay, so let me stop you there.
Yeah, okay.
Thought log. It's just like a notebook.
Yeah, just like a notebook.
Is it in your phone or is it actual paper?
Oh, no, I do everything on actual paper. I don't do... I keep a hard copy calendar. People look at me like I'm like...
Like the Far Side?
Yeah,
like the cartoon?
They're like, are you secretly 100? And you just like... are well preserved.
I get that. I don't have any problem with like people who are old school and write by hand and use hard copy stuff.
Yeah. So I keep a hard copy calendar. I have a hard copy notebook. The only problem is that if you lose it, which has happened to me, you are like really fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I lose my calendar, I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea where I'm supposed to be.
Do you draft your books by hand?
No.
Okay.
No.
I'm
like a note taker by hand. And sometimes, you know, I might write scenes or do some kind of work outside the laptop. But no, I do. I mean, I type my drafts. But the thought log is just sort of a way of recording what I'm, paying attention to and what's on my mind.
So how, like, what does this actually look like in practice? Like, do you set a time? Do you have to do it every day? Or is it just when the mood is there? You know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
I aspire to do it on sort of like a regular daily basis. That doesn't, sometimes there's a gap between aspiration and execution. But I try and be fairly consistent about it. And there's not really, I'm not like a methodical person in general when it comes to sort of, you know, record keeping and note taking and stuff like that. So there's not a set form that it has to take. It's just, I mean, if you look through it, it would just look like a jumble. But
do you have it on you?
I do not.
Oh, you do not.
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to have you read from it, but...
I actually probably would refuse to do that.
But it's just like things that are like you're reading certain news stories, catch your eye, or you see something in the street.
Totally, or details, yeah. And so I had been writing about... I'd been writing about horror films a lot to myself. I had been writing a lot. I was sort of, this was a time, because my second story collection and first novel, they came out in fairly close succession. So there was a period of time where I was traveling a lot. I should also say Claire, the narrator, is a sales rep for an elevator technology. And so she travels just like constantly on the road. So I wrote some of the kind of travel sections, you know, in my notebook when I was moving through all of these transit spaces, like, you know, airports and hotel rooms and...
Did you find a fingernail in the night?
I did. I know. And so many people have asked me that, like, yeah. How did you come up with the detail? And I'm like, it happened to
God.
Me.
That's like upsetting. My fucking nightmare.
It was an acrylic nail, which isn't like quite as...
Okay. Now you're bringing me back a little bit. I thought it was like off the body.
Yeah. It's an acrylic nail. But it was like sitting like right on top of the Bible. And it still was like...
That's like a Lynchian detail to me.
It was very startling. So I made it a real fingernail. So I just made it like a little bit grosser.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's a lesson in how to write good fiction.
Yeah, make it a little bit closer.
Make it real.
Yeah, make it a little bit grosser than it was in actual life.
Okay, so... When you say you wrote sections, like travel sections of the book in your thought log, does that mean like verbatim or does that mean you were just sketching?
Just sketching. Yeah, just sketching. I mean, for example, the fingernail I put in the thought log because I was like, this won't
happen. Did you actually press the acrylic nail inside the thought log like a flower?
No. No. I like wrapped it up in a tissue and threw it away.
Did you actually? Okay. But you didn't have like the weird, like fear impulse to eat it.
No, I didn't.
Ladies and gentlemen, and make it like a little bit grosser.
A lot grosser.
All right. So... Like one of the things that strikes me, and I don't know, do you want to keep going on thought log? Did I cut you off?
No, I can keep. Yeah, I can keep. Why don't you? You were struck.
Okay.
So tell me.
I'm struck by, first of all, how good you are at this. You're really good writer. I think that you're like one of these people where I'm like, she is doing what she should be doing. Like this is your gift. And I'm also struck by, excellent visual detail, like for example this fingernail and like the atmospherics of Havana, which mm-hmm. I've been there before years and years. I was there in 2001.
Oh wow, yeah, very so, different moment than
very
like
different
2014
moment.
2015
yeah. Yeah, it was like, I mean, I don't know how much it's changed because I haven't been back, but I'm assuming since it opened up a little bit it's probably gotten more, you know, modernized or whatever. But when I was there it was like, you know, Castro was still alive, we weren't supposed to really be there, and you know, all the old cars, and it was very, very rustic or whatever. But anyway, I know from having been there, like how photogenic that place is.
Sure.
Like few places like bring like that much to the table visually.
Absolutely.
And so it's like a feast, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm imagining you now with your thought log roaming the streets of Havana and, you know, reading your book brings me back mm-hmm. and you're just like, wow, there's so much happening there. It's a rich culture.
Yeah. It's a very rich culture. I mean, it's a very rich city. I'm going to pause for a second to sort of backtrack to like fully answer your question of how I got there.
Yeah.
If I may. So I was writing about horror films in the thought log. I was writing about travel. I grew up in Orlando, Florida.
Which we talked about that in our first conversation.
Yeah. And so, Orlando is a part of, the state that has been really powerfully shaped by tourism in respect to like economy, culture, how the place is narrated to, by outsiders, et cetera. And so that whole landscape has long interested me. And then when the travel regulations to go to Cuba were loosened, in like late 2014-ish, all of a sudden Havana was in like every travel magazine, every travel blogger was writing about it. And I became really interested in the way that the city was being narrated and what was being foregrounded, what was being left out, how the narratives might be sort of incomplete, who it seemed like the narratives were being written for, et cetera. And so that whole landscape started to really interest me too and kind of went into the thought log. But it also took me like quite a while to, you know, I had like a constellation of jellyfish is sort of how it felt in my imagination, but it was what could link these things together or how could these things come to kind of live in the same space? And there were two things that bridged the world of like travel, tourism, and film. The first was discovering this movie called Juan of the Dead that came out in 2011 and was widely sort of heralded as Cuba's first horror movie. It's a zombie movie. It's like very bloody and funny, and it's like rich social commentary. And so that was a link between like the world of film and also place. And then thing that was sort of a further bridge was I went to, I was at a talk and a scholar was giving a talk on consumer culture in contemporary Havana. And I realized at a certain point, because I've been reading a lot of film theory, that the language that she was using, she was talking about like lenses and gazes and so on, to talk about tourism was so similar to cinematic language. And that was actually like a huge breakthrough and really gave me a lot of ideas of how, the world of travel, the world of film could be.
So wait, say that again. Like, what's the connection you found?
Yeah. So she was giving a talk on consumer culture in contemporary Havana. She was talking a lot about tourism and the language, like the vocabulary she was using, you know, talking about like lenses, for example, and using the word lens in the context of talking about consumer culture and tourism. If you're reading film theory, you're going to hear the word lens like a lot. So just realizing that there is overlap in vocabulary, right? And that there is this sort of synergy between those two worlds, like that was a very important discovery.
Okay, so that was good. I mean, that kind of brings me to my next thing. We can keep talking about Havana and Cuba because there's a lot to discuss, but it also hit me that, you know, you have been paying very close attention to film and you have a real preoccupation with it. And there's obviously like the Hitchcockian, if that's a word, influence. And I'm sure there are other influences in there, but, can you talk a bit about your interest in film? Because I mean, you've already started down that path, but I'm curious to know, like, first of all, like what the history of it is, or if this is kind of a new development like boxing
and then also,
this is how the book reads to me. If you were thinking of film structure and adaptation or possible adaptation, and you know, horror films and you know, the atmospherics are all there. Like, is this something that was in your brain as you set out to plot this and write it?
Yeah. You know, I think one thing that the thought log helps me make a distinction between is what is the stuff that I think is just like neat, but doesn't necessarily have the kind of mystery and weight and resonance that I feel like is necessary for fiction. Like I love dogs. I met your very nice puppy earlier. My love for dogs is like not complicated.
I know this from Twitter.
Yeah.
I want to say you do a lot of dog tweeting.
I think dogs are like one of the best things that this terrible world has to offer us. So, but my love for dogs is like completely uncomplicated. It would not be interesting in a narrative context because there's no friction. The story would be like, I love dogs. They're great. The end. So I think that, you know, the thought log helps me make distinctions between what's interesting in kind of in an uncomplicated way and what's interesting in a more complicated and a more layered sort of way. And I think with film, I mean, I love film. I've been interested in film for a long time. I've loved horror for a long time. So that's been a part of my life for a while. It was not so much a recent development, as boxing, but I do feel a lot of complicated feelings about the genre. I think in some ways the genre kind of imprinted on me as a young person because, you know, it was the only action genre that I was exposed to where women were regularly the heroes and the protagonists. Like when I was a teenager, like a young, you know, younger teenager, it's like the Scream movies, I Know What You Did Last Summer, that whole genre of the sort of slasher and the kind of the kind of update of The Final Girl was like super in pop culture. But you know, your lens changes, to go back to the word lens, with time, right? And there are qualities about some of those narratives that you could read through a feminist lens, but also, you know, I think there's the sort of subtext of the final girls having to essentially adopt patriarchal violence in order to survive. And if you're looking at it through that lens, then the story becomes a lot more complicated. So thinking about horror and feeling like complicated mixed feelings about horror and gender, but also one thing that I love about the genre And I think the best examples of the genre are so powerful in this way, is that horror through these extreme dislocations of reality has a way at uncovering these fundamental human questions. Who can you trust? Who am I? What ways have I denied sort of truths, you know, personal history, national history, cultural history, and what's the cost of that looking away? All of those kinds of instabilities in our lives, like horror, a really good horror movie is so brilliant at just finding like a new expression for a really like central human story.
Can you give me an example of some horror films that might have influenced you or that you just really love?
Yeah, of course. So for something that's more recent that I always think of when I'm talking about that sort of, you know, that assertion that the best horror films tell, find kind of a new language and visual language, because it is on screen for kind of central human stories, is I loved The Babadook, Jennifer Kent's movie, The Babadook, which I found really terrifying. But it's, have you seen The Babadook?
I'm scared to watch it.
Oh, okay.
I got to get into it. It's always at night on like my Netflix and I'm like, I can do The Babadook, but I don't know if I'm ready for that ride.
I mean, it's pretty scary. And I think also, you know, you have a kid. Yeah. I think that my friends with parents, or my friends who are parents, found it like particularly frightening because it involves a mother and a young son, and she's a widow. She's raising, you know, her child on her own, and he is a kid with some issues, and so they're socially isolated, and there's just a tremendous amount of pressure on them for various reasons, and then they come to be menaced by this presence called the Babadook. And the movie does this really brilliant thing where the force of the haunting is so powerfully felt, but the creature is never fully revealed. So, you know, there's that ambiguity of like, is this an outside force that has been beset upon them, or has their psychological weather somehow generated this thing called the Babadook? And the most frightening thing for me is not so much the creature, but what, how mother and son sort of turn on each other, and what the mother character in particular becomes, under kind of the spell of the Babadook. So it's so much like, it is this incredible film about trust, identity, violence, the limits of love, the limits of patience, and our ability to sort of turn on the people who are like closest and most important to us.
You're really selling this to me.
You're like, I am never watching that ever.
By the way, I like your phrase, psychological weather. I just want to point that out.
Thank you.
How is your psychological weather, by the way? Is it pretty good?
I think it's...
Feels good?
Yeah.
So,
I mean...
72 and sunny?
Yeah, 72 and sunny. So, so far, so good.
Anything else, like, film-wise that you can point to? I don't mean to make you enumerate, because that can be, like, onerous, but, like I'm just curious to know about... Like, are there Hitchcock films that you like?
For sure. I love Hitchcock. And also, to go back to complicated feelings about horror, you know, I love Hitchcock. Hitchcock has been a huge influence for me. I mean, he's also, like, a world-class misogynist. So I've been thinking about that a lot. Like, what does it mean as a woman artist to have been so influenced by an artist whose like worldview, both in life and in cinema, was so rooted in, you know, misogyny?
Well, what's that line in the book where somebody
torture the women?
Torture the women.
Yeah,
that's the
torture
secret.
Torture the women, and indeed, like both on screen and off, he was big on torturing women. So, but I love Vertigo was a really important movie for me. I mean, certainly like The Birds, Psycho. I mean, he was, I think, a really, you know, his singular filmmaker in a lot of ways. But I feel, you know, I feel complicated feelings about Hitchcock. Another movie that I really studied for structure with The Third Hotel, because I wanted the progression to be, I wanted the book to become increasingly claustrophobic as you move through time. And I wanted the sort of spatial elements of the novel to change. And I rewatched Halloween, the original Halloween, several times and really like studied it for structure. It is like a perfect movie.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And
I haven't seen that, and I don't even know if I've ever seen it.
It's so, I mean, I think like each, you know, subsequent installment gets like a little bit worse.
Well, it's hard to sustain.
The first one is definitely, as usual, the first one is the best one, but it's, you know, say for the opening sequence when Michael Myers is a child, the movie's 85 minutes long and no one dies for 55 minutes. So it's all dread. It's all anticipation. And you start in daylight in these sort of leafy, you know, wide suburban streets. And then as night falls, the use of the spatial possibilities become more and more and more and more constricted. And then there's this like violent unleashing in the last, you know, 30 or so minutes. And so the structure of it is really incredible. And the sense of suspense, anticipation, dread the movie generates, I think, is also really incredible. But I really studied it for the way it used space and the way that space was narrowed. Throughout the film.
Okay. So you have your thought log. You're studying films for structure. So you're outlining then? Are you jotting down notes?
I'm just annotating. There's no system. It's just like if I like think a thought and I think I want to remember that thought and not forget it in like 10 minutes, then I write it down.
But like when you're watching Halloween for structure and space, you know, space stuff or whatever, like you're jotting down thoughts there. Are you plotting? Like, are you pre-plotting your book? Are you thinking about the end? Or, you know what I'm saying? Like, how much of it is there when you sit down to actually draft?
Oh, I don't have anything. I have ideas. I have, like, matter, but I don't have jellyfish. I have the constellation of jellyfish, but I have very little in the way of plot. Because I think ideally, you know, a plot in fiction is not just sort of a container for the jellyfish, right? But it I'm sorry. I don't think I can carry the jellyfish metaphor any farther. So I'm gonna switch.
I was there with them.
It's not just a vessel for the ideas, right? But it gives the ideas an animation and a body. It sort of breathes them out onto the page. And so I think to find, you know, a plot that that can give sort of physical shape to those ideas and to let them, you know, not just be sort of stated, but to really kind of exist in the world. Like, that's the stuff for me that takes years and years and years and years and years.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, too, because I'm hearing you talk about the process that you go through in writing your books. And, you know, I'm thinking about all this note taking that you do in your thought log and how you have these different areas of interest that are sort of percolating in your mind or constellating undersea or whatever. And then I'm thinking about, you know, the critical reception for your novel. Like this one specifically, I guess like all of your work or could maybe be characterized like this, but specifically for The Third Hotel, the word layered comes up in multiple reviews. I don't know if you read them.
But, I do, yeah.
Yeah, I find that interesting because it's like, oh, so now I'm seeing why it's having that effect on people. Like, you're finding this crossover. That must be gratifying in a way.
It's so gratifying. Yeah, you're like, yes, I work so hard to try and you know, there were drafts that were totally the like ungainly, here's every neat thing I learned about film theory that the characters will like randomly say apropos of nothing, right? I mean, I definitely had those drafts where so I think that, right, to create, and I love hybridity, perhaps because of my sign, always feels very natural to me in fiction. So, I mean, I love work that bends genres, right, and kind of contains multiple worlds in one space. I love films that do that. Like, another horror film that I thought that did that so well is A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which that's a very stylish horror movie. So maybe that wouldn't be as scary. You could watch that one, I think.
I think you could
handle it. It's like in black and white. It's very cool. But the director called it, you know, it's a little tongue in cheek, but also it's true that the first spaghetti Western Iranian vampire movie. And it's shot in black and white, and it's like punk and goth and retro and industrial and contemporary. I mean, it's so many things simultaneously. Also, I think is, you know, there is a real, like a genuinely feminist narrative in that movie. So it feels like it's drawing from so many different pools to create this like completely seamless ocean of experience. And that,
so many jellyfish.
Yes. Yeah, so many jellyfish. And that I feel like is kind of it's my cinematic ideal, but it's also my ideal in fiction, where you feel like the writer has maybe pulled from these really different pools, both in terms of influence and reference, but also like what they and only they can bring to the work. And they've created this sort of seamless space where all of these jellyfish can live together happily in harmony.
Now I'm thinking about my sign and this question of vanity. And I'm also thinking like from a writing perspective and a reading perspective, how much I like books that are about themselves and about their own creation. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That feels problematic to me.
Well,
or it feels like an affirmation of my fear.
Yeah, of the double Leo.
Yeah, the double me.
Yeah.
Just like can't get over myself. I got to break out.
Do you mean like Knausgard?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
That's too much. But that's also like maximal. Maximal. It's maximal that.
Yeah. I read part of the first one and I actually liked it, but there's just so much of it.
Life's
short.
I'm fickle with books.
Yeah.
I'm fickle with books. I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know if you're a omnivorous reader or somebody who can kind of pick up any old book and just like plow through it.
Yeah.
Can you do that?
Not really. I'll pick up stuff and sometimes it's the book, but sometimes I know it's me. Like it's really, I'm not meeting this book at the right moment in time. This isn't what I'm in the mood for. It's not sort of like where my psychological weather is situated, but
right.
I'll read, if I read 20 or 25 pages that I'm still sort of like, unless there's a reason that I must finish it, like a review or something like that. And I don't actually review a lot. So it's infrequent that happens. I'll put it down and go on to something else. But if I get past page 50 or so, unless the book is, unless it's like a really long book, then I'll usually stay with it. Even if my love for it is sort of cooling. Besides, like, we've come this far together.
Let's see this thing through.
I feel like I'm locked in. Let's see this thing through. But because I know that about myself, I'm fairly particular about what I will like go the distance with.
And if you're working on a book like this, this recent one, and you sort of, once you've gotten enough, thoughts logged in your thought log and you sort of start to get a clear sense of what your, preoccupations are, like what the themes are that you want to work on with the subject, like what these disparate, jellyfish or subject matter, are,
mm-hmm.
then I would imagine you start to turn to film and literature, that can specifically feed that or answer questions. You talked, for example, about reading a lot of film theory.
Yeah.
Was this something you were doing prior to all this, just as like something you like to do? Or were there specific questions that you had that you wanted answers to? And if so, like, well, who are some of these theorists that you were reading?
Yeah. So, I mean, both. I had read some film theory just out of my own interest, but for sure made it. I mean, that became a huge part of my reading life, because I knew I was working on this project and I just wanted to know more. I think a very Gemini thing is to like know like two things about 100 things, right? To have this like very superficial knowledge of a lot of things. But
wait,
like,
maybe I'm a Gemini. I feel like I'm like that too.
Maybe you need to have your chart redone.
I think I do. Anyway, continue.
But I think that so I know that about myself, and so the things that I like really want to kind of like intellectually invest in and emotionally invest in, I've like really sort of make a kind of practice of it. So I made myself a big reading list with a lot, like a certain amount of time a week to read, read for the novel explicitly, whether it was fiction or nonfiction. And I think that there, one book, and this is kind of a seminal book, I think, in horror film theory was Carol Clover's Men, Women, and Chainsaws. And do you know what's amazing? I'm an anxious flyer, and I don't want anyone to talk to me on the plane. Like, I just need to be completely silent.
Do you medicate?
No, I don't medicate.
You just like not even a cocktail. Nothing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends on the time of day. I might have like a drink or something unless it's like 8 a.m. But no, I mean, I'm usually like more or less unmedicated. But it's like always when you're in that headspace, there'll be like some man next to you who just wants to like talk and talk and talk.
Earbuds. You got to put on the headphones.
Yeah. Sometimes that doesn't even, they're like tap you on the arm and they're like still talking.
Yeah.
But when you're reading Men, Women, and Chainsaws and it's like a screaming woman with a giant chainsaw on the cover, nobody talks to you. It's incredible. That was like some of the greatest, and other books that have these like very, horrifying titles. I think people like look at, and they're big books too, so it's sort of a little bit more visible. Like people will look at the title and be like, "Yeah, I'm gonna talk to the person.
I'm gonna take a pass on this person.
I'm gonna take a pass on this person.
It's a weirdo in the middle seat.
I feel like I would like to just like tear off the cover and like stick like a different book inside, so I can keep, I could keep using it. But that cheap. coined the idea of the final girl and wrote about it there and it's a novel or sorry.
For listeners who might not be familiar with the term, can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, so the final girl is the archetypal female protagonist in a horror film who survives at the end. So Laurie Strode from Halloween would be a classic example. Sydney Prescott from Scream.
The Neve Campbell character.
Yeah, the Neve Campbell character. So it's the lone female survivor who defeats the killer, at least in that sort of installment. But also I think she does and she doesn't, because when you get into the franchise, that she defeats the killer, but the killer is sort of unstoppable in some ways, you know. So franchises complicate that narrative a little bit. So, but Carol Clover's book is about gender and horror and about the final girl sort of theory, but about other aspects of gender and horror too.
You know, all this like intellectual sophistication and all of this layered meaning in horror films. I'm interested to know, like having read all of this theory around this topic, how much of it is or feels like really explicit, and how much of it is sort of there and is being parsed after the fact by interested viewers. You know, it's like I can imagine instances where very interesting films about the female experience or female characters or films that like speak to feminist concerns could be made by male directors who had no real idea that they were doing it. And then how many of them, you know, because there are also. Like really sophisticated social and cultural messages embedded into these films, as you talked about earlier.
Absolutely.
And I think like most prominently in the recent past about Get Out.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, and how this film like just hit so many notes and spoke to the culture, you know, in this really like varied way. You know, that felt intentional.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about that? Like, do you have a sense of it? And especially like, I guess, maybe in older horror films, but it's interesting to me that this, the kind of pulpy, sensational genre would have all this action happening below the surface,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. That's a tough question to answer. I mean, there's certainly some films where the engagement with culture is, I mean, it's not subtext, right? Like it's integral to the plot. You know, when you think of a film like, you know, I mean, some people say, you know, The Shining is about indigenous genocide, right? Like, I'm not completely convinced by that.
I've never heard that, but
yeah, interpretation. But it's you know, I think particularly for films that are classics. You know, our classics, whether they're like cult classics or like really kind of firmly in the canon classics. This can be true of literary works too. It becomes difficult to know at a certain point where like the director's intentionality ends and fan theory begins, right? Like, what was that Kubrick's intent? You know, I mean, there's a lot of like projecting that we do on.
Have you seen that documentary about The Shining? What's it called? It's called like Room 517.
It was quite a while ago. So I don't remember it super well, but I'm familiar with it.
Just like the level. I mean, Kubrick is a guy where intentionality is like taken to the extreme.
For sure. But also intentionality can be misunderstood too. So, right. So just because he intended something does not necessarily mean that the viewer is, their interpretation of intent is like aligned with his actual intent. Does that make sense?
Yeah. People can spiral with his films. Like that's what that movie's all about.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So this is sort of like circularity of spiraling deeper into the world. And I mean, his films do feel so sort of coded in terms of representation of like image and numbers and how this kind of visual nightmare logic, how everything links up. But I think just sort of more generally, you know, one thing to me that's kind of extraordinary about a movie or about a book is that I think in some ways it's like 50% text and 50%, you know, viewer/reader, which is to say there was, from my perspective, a lot of intention in writing The Third Hotel, you know, and I was making a lot of choices sort of very explicitly, particularly in the later stages where I'm sort of more attuned to the landscape and how it's being shaped, and I'm out of the wild wilderness of the early drafts. So of course I'm making choices, and of course I'm doing it with intention and thought and so on. But, you know, sometimes like you have that experience of a reader reading a book and they have a reading that's been really meaningful to them. And it's like not necessarily what I intended, but it's also like I'm not going to tell them that their reading is wrong because it's an experience that they've had. And in a certain way, my intent is sort of like irrelevant at a certain point.
It's a collaboration.
Yeah.
I mean, imaginatively, right?
Right. And I do think it is a collaboration. And so if you have a really, you know, if you have a really powerful experience with The Shining and there's a meaning there that you, you know, access, it's sort of, you know, the director's intent is not relevant necessarily.
I thought The Shining was about me as a true Leo.
Did you? You
no,
did
I'm
not.
Just kidding.
Yeah. I was going to say, if you feel like The Shining is about you, I have so many questions.
No.
Where is the exit from the studio? Like, number one.
There's
most
two.
Immediate
There's actually
question.
Two. You can get out.
Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you about with regard to horror is, and I guess maybe this is sort of dovetails with mentioning Get Out, but there are other films too. It's not just that film. And that film I don't think was the point of Genesis, but it definitely feels like there's been a moment, like a good moment, in film history and in cultural history for horror mm-hmm. as a genre.
Yeah.
Like I've found myself being like, you know what? I really like horror films, especially in the theater.
Yeah.
Which is an experience that I think is sort of going by the wayside. You know, that communal viewing experience
sure.
in a darkened theater. A lot of people are just staying at home and watching it on their flat screen or whatever. And I get that. But there's something really fun about watching a really good horror film in the theater with other people and hearing the screams. And then there's a lot of laughter in horror movies, you know, some sort of like anxious laughter that happens or,
yeah.
you know, there's a lot of comedy in horror films, or there often is. And so I'm curious to know if in conceiving this book, you thought at all about that, the kind of cultural moment that we were in and also the profitability of horror narratives. Cause they're like in the film world, they're cheap to make.
Yeah.
Relatively speaking.
Right.
And they can be hugely profitable if they
yeah.
hit. So, you know, like, I guess being in LA, I'm proximal to all this, but, you know, you can, there are a million examples of films that were like, you know, micro budget and then went on to
right.
make like
the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like Blumhouse, you know,
yeah.
like he's just raking in money. Cause like thing about it, like mathematically is that like they don't all have to hit like
right.
one hit. Like Get Out
yeah.
will finance like 20 duds or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering like if you made any kind of like practical decision creatively about what project to work on next and said, you know what I'm going to try to do? I'm going to try to take this genre, which is pop culture
mm-hmm.
and pulpy or whatever you want to call it. And then add, like you were talking about earlier, the kind of gravity that literature requires. Is that part of the calculus? Are you thinking about the market at all?
No, I'm not. I can't. I mean, I want people to read. Like, I love readers, and I want people to read my work, and I'm grateful every time someone does. So I don't mean that in the sort of like, oh, like I don't, you know, I don't care about readers. I don't care about being read. Like, absolutely, that matters to me very much. But I can't make work from that sort of place where
yeah.
I'm thinking about the marketplace or trying to write, you know, to the marketplace. And, you know, there are probably some writers that do have a real knack for that. But I think also for novels, it's often just impractical because they take so long unless you're writing something that can be written really quickly. You know, if you're going to work on a novel for 5 years, the marketplace that you thought you were writing towards could in fact be completely different by the time it's released. So for me, there's a philosophical sort of artistic blockade with that way of thinking, but it also like just it very rarely kind of works in practice.
But I would argue that like the book that you've just published is actually beautifully timed and contains all these things that are happening in the culture, like to keep, you know, to extend the jellyfish metaphor.
Yeah.
Like you're like I think really, gifted creative people, like just have that antenna and are very awake and tuned in and noticing what they notice and putting it in their thought log or somehow like filtering it into their creative work. And they, you know, it's like a representative man or a representative woman. They're sort of like capturing this stuff for the rest of us. So that's kind of how I felt. And then like Cuba and horror, I don't know. To me, it felt perfectly timed. So I would kind of be like, maybe you did it by accident.
Yeah, it was, I think that there was a lot of, you know, like a lot of serendipity there. I can't even imagine how I would have like engineered it in a super conscious way. I did pin the setting in Havana in 2015 because I did want to the novel to be rooted in a recent moment, but a moment that's distinct from like the moment that we're in, you know, right now. But I think you just, you know, you've just got to sort of do your thing and
hope people respond.
Yeah, I mean, you
trust your instincts,
right? And there's also only so much you can control, right? And when I'm talking about kind of serendipity and timing and all that, I mean, you know, a different constellation of factors and that the timing looks like really different, right? And the creator has so little control. Unless they're writing something that really is about some, you know, if you were doing something like a documentary on like the Me Too movement, I mean, there's certain things, right, where you are aware of sort of timeliness, and this is a direct engagement with like a national conversation. But I want to go back to something that, because I think that, you know, that is the sort of counter argument, to horror, that idea that it's not, often they're not as expensive to make as films, and that they can accrue this sort of mass popularity very quickly. And Claire has a conversation with a documentarian at some point in the book. And, his kind of argument against horror is that it basically like you don't risk enough when you're watching a horror film, that you know, what people want, which is sort of when people are like, doesn't it scare you too much to, you know, to watch horror? And I'm like, I feel like it gives you kind of a safe catharsis, or it brings you to the edge of the abyss. But then you have a kind of contract with the film, because it's a film, that you'll be brought back to shore by the end. And the documentarian was sort of arguing against that there's too much sort of safety in horror. And so that's it's an interesting, you know, is an interesting way of thinking about it as a sort of counterpoint to it, that it claims to be this genre that, you know, can frighten the daylights out of people, or like frighten them into a new way of thinking about or seeing the world. But does it really, or does it ultimately work to kind of comfort or console the viewer?
Well, yeah, no, it's an interesting, I see it as like a ritual, you know, especially for people who are deeply invested in it and who kind of go to the theater to see every horror movie that comes out and like really get into it, you know? It's like, you know what you're going to get to a degree, and you put yourself through, the experience so that you can kind of have that tension and release. And I don't know. I guess when I was a kid, I went through like a very concentrated horror phase in junior high where I watched like everything. I just went to the, back in the day, went to the video store.
Blockbuster.
Yeah, not even. It was just like the local, like in the strip mall in Indiana kind of thing. And like, I just cleaned out the horror shelves. I watched everything.
Mm-hmm.
Could not get enough. And I later learned like that is tied a lot to like the dawn of adolescence and puberty, and like that age is like ripe for that kind of stuff.
Transformation.
All that kind of stuff, like blood and guts and bodily fluids and like all that kind of stuff. So I watched it and then kind of like phased out of it. And then only recently, you know, I've been like, I really like that experience of going to the theater and just being scared shitless.
Yeah.
And especially like externalizing it. Cause I don't want, like, there's something about having children. This might sound a little trite, but like having kids and then like having a heightened sensitivity to violence on film, and like, you know, I've got enough fear.
You know? Your relationship to fear changes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I do like, you know, as an experience to go to the theater and do it, you know, it's kind of coming back to me, I guess, is my point.
Yeah.
But before I let you go, cause you know, we've talked so much about horror and film, we've talked about Havana, but we have not talked about marriage, which factors in, and which is which is on the mind of this book in a big way. Relationships, you know, intimate relationship in particular, how people can be married, you know, engaged in an intimate relationship, but also like alone within that, all the weird dynamics that go into, being with someone. And, you know, can you talk about how that, like, where did that jellyfish come from?
Yeah, well, I mean, I sort of think we're, like, all alone, even when we're together, is my maybe general worldview.
Especially writers.
Yeah, especially writers. I think, I mean, I'm interested in, you know, I'm interested in sort of, like, the you know, to go back, this maybe will appeal to you as a Leo, if you like thinking about the self. I think Gemini's like thinking about the self too, for sure. But, you know, how we sort of negotiate like public self, private self, and secret self. And I think the secret self is being, you know, the part of the self that we don't even really understand, where our sort of the like impulse to like eat the fingernail in the hotel room drawer comes from, where we have those moments where we're like...
And you're sure that didn't happen?
I'm positive
for you.
That didn't happen.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to hold that line. But with those moments where we give ourselves a kind of like, what the fuck was that moment? Like, why did I do that? Why did I think that? Why did I say that? Where is that coming from?
Right.
And, you know, and I think in, you know, it doesn't have to be marriage necessarily. That's just as a married person, sort of a, like a, an experiential context that I was working, you know, working in. But I mean, it could be, you know, parent to child, between siblings, any kind of like intimate partnership or really close friendship. I mean, I think there are many contexts in when that sort of, you know, that negotiation of public, private, and secret can become really complicated. And, you know, that idea of like, if the secret self is a thing that we don't necessarily always have conscious access to and thus can't really give another person access to in the way that we can give someone entry into like the private self, right? You know, what does that mean for a relationship? And you know, in the case of Claire and Richard, like what happens if that secret space is maybe holding matter that is frightening in some ways? And I think, you know, I'm also interested in this, the kind of relational quality of it too. Like if there's something about your spouse that you really don't know or don't understand and find it out sort of in a very, at a very belated moment in time and are alarmed, like what does that say about your own gaze and the incompleteness of your own sight?
And your own lens.
Your own lens. Yeah. We're just going to keep bringing you back to jellyfish and lens and astrology. Fantastic. But what does that say about your own lens and kind of the incompleteness of your own sight? And if you weren't looking like here, then where were you looking?
So, it's really disorienting.
Yeah.
To think you know somebody and then to find out like very sharply that you don't know them as well as you thought you did.
Right. Or that their limits of knowing, and you kind of, I think this is actually a line in the book that just to sort of summarize it, that you don't know the limits of knowing until you've surpassed them. Right. So often exactly what you're saying, I think that's so true, that you don't know, like with a sibling, for example, or with your partner, you don't know all that you didn't know until you're sort of out on that cliff where you're like, holy cow, I had no idea that this was going on, or had no idea that they were capable of doing something like this. And I think, I mean, as someone who's like married to, you know, a really wonderful human, and I don't think of our relationship as being like dense with that kind of potentially toxic or frightening secrecy. But I think also the real life manifestation, it is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, sometimes the limits of our knowledge and then surpassing those limits in some ways can, you know, can surprise us in like the loveliest of ways, where all of a sudden a person like reveals a new dimension or accesses a new dimension in their own self, and then kind of you're able to access that dimension in turn. And so I think the kind of contract we make of the, you know, inability to know anyone completely is part of what can make a long relationship sort of dynamic over time. So it doesn't,
as soon as this is over, I'm going to go in and tell my wife that I'm a double Leo.
Yeah. I know. And
she's going to be thrilled.
Yeah. Is she into astrology, or will she be like, what's that?
Yeah. She'll be like, what's that?
Yeah.
But you know what I'm thinking, like just like projecting my own experience onto it, like as a father of two young kids, and my son's got, you know, health challenges. And so like that adds a layer of busyness, is like how you can be in an intimate relationship with someone. And it doesn't mean that kids are the only context in which this could happen, but just like professionally,
yeah,
you can both be super invested and busy and traveling and dealing with stuff and have a lot of different demands on your time.
Absolutely.
And you can be married or in an intimate relationship with somebody, sharing space with them, seeing them every day.
Yeah.
And yet like some days, I'll like be in the, I'll walk in the house and I'll walk through the kitchen, and I'll, like my kids will be like, ah, and I'll like pass my wife and I'll be like, hey, she'll be like, hey. And it's like I'm passing her in the street almost. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
no, I totally, for sure. I mean, I think there have been moments in my, you know, marriage where I've totally felt that way, even though we just have a big dog. So no kids. But I think with just the busyness and the travel and the kind of coming and going. And I think that that's also, again, in a long relationship, really of any kind, it's like people change over time, right? But if you're in this sort of constant motion and your eye is on that ball, I think it's very possible to miss the way people are changing.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you sort of see them again after the change or the transformation has been completed, and you're like, where did that person go? And who is this person that's replaced them? And I think that that can be disconcerting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like there's a lot of mystery to it.
Yeah.
You know, you think like...
There is a lot of mystery.
Yeah, and I think that's the way it's always been. And I think maybe it can be easy for people to misperceive how it's supposed to be. I guess it depends on what you have to model, or just like what your sign is or what your temperament is. But, you know, you're never going to be able to fully know another person. And I sort of feel like, you know, just thinking about it out loud, I'd rather have a little mystery.
I think
who wants to know everything? Like, who wants to reach some finite point where you're like, I got it.
That's right. And I think the sort of opposite thing is, it's like that, you know, is the answer to this, we need to somehow access like the secret self of the people closest to us. And I think, no, right? I mean, we don't know. I mean, privacy to me is such an important part of identity. I think privacy is different than secrecy also, but privacy is it's an important part of what makes us human, and sort of privacy, respecting sort of a privacy of the self and also privacy of the others is, I think can be a really healthy thing in a relationship. And that, right, instead of to be sort of made anxious about the mystery, to accept the mystery and embrace it and move deeper into it and find beauty in it too. And I think that there is often a lot of beauty in it, but I think in the case of Claire and Richard, it also becomes, you know, I think that that is very much their story, where they've both been, even though they're married, they've been sort of ships in the night for so long. And then they arrive at this moment where they've both undergone kind of radical changes, and they've missed the process. They're sort of seeing each other like at the end point before he dies, but they've missed the process. So there's this feeling of like two strangers living in the same house.
And then he dies.
And then he dies.
Wow. Well,
but then he like kind of comes back.
Right.
Maybe.
And you'll have to read to learn more.
Yes.
It's a wonderful book. You're a terrific writer of fiction.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think you're one of our very best. And I appreciate you making the time. I know you're working on another story collection.
I am, yeah. I'm working on stories, a collection that should be out in like 2020, probably. So a couple years away.
Horror? Like, what? Can you give us any hints?
Not horror, although I will say, I mean, I think I'm working on kind of putting the collection together now. I do think there are a lot of like ghosts in there. Both like there's a haunted house story, so in some cases like literal, and in some cases sort of in the more ephemeral sense.
Any other jellyfish you care to share?
Oh, let's see. A lot of sisters, a lot of travel, a little auto fiction, which is new for me.
Huh. That strikes a chord with me.
Yeah.
Is there any podcasters in your collection?
That live in LA and have two children and a puppy.
Oh man. Well, it's good to see you. I really appreciate you making the time, and, you know, you're going to boxing next, right?
I'm going to boxing next.
Laura, for those of you listening, I don't know if we said this explicitly while we were recording or if it was during soundcheck, but you actually asked if you could change her. You got to suit up to go boxing with your niece.
I got to put on my workout clothes. My niece is also a boxer, so she's going to take me to her usual gym, and we're going to...
Who started first?
I think we started around the same time. I'll have to ask her, but I feel like she started sometime last year.
Okay. You know, like I used to, just to bring this full circle, I used to go to a yoga class that Gina Gershon would go to. And then I want to say I read something about her and how she was sparring partners with Bob Dylan.
Really? That's incredible.
Random. Like, wow. But she's a boxer, and I guess Bob Dylan likes to box.
Yeah. I can see it.
I can see that too, in a weird way. So maybe at the gym, you will see Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
You are here in LA.
I'll keep an eye out.
All right. Well, it's great to see you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay. That's Laura Vandenberg. What do you think of that? Her new novel, is called The Third Hotel. It is out there now from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Laura Vandenberg, The Third Hotel. Go get your copy. Read this novel. It's so good. She's so good at it. Her website is lauravandenberg.com. Her Twitter handle is @LVandenberg. The Third Hotel. Thanks to Kill Rock Stars and the band Stereo Total, as always, for the theme song music. Thank you to the band Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. That's right, it's Tiger in My Tank. I made the official correction last week, but I'll do it again. The album is called Cigarette Royalty. The band is called Tiger in My Tank. I stand corrected. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I apologize. If you want to write to me, the email address is letters@otherppl.com. If you want to support the show, patreon.com/otherpplpod. What else? Oh, if you want to get the app, the Other People app, that's free. Go get it wherever you get your apps. Get the Other People app on your phone. You can look at it. You can touch it. You can say to yourself, I have this app. You know what I mean. I like that Laura Vandenberg boxes. I want you to know, I can't remember, did we talk about this? She left my house and went straight to go boxing. With, like, I think her niece or something. She's not fucking around. She's here to fight. I was thinking about something similar this morning, unrelated. Like, I did not have my conversation with Laura Vandenberg in my brain. I was actually driving past Camp Pendleton as I was coming home from taking Twiggy to see her Marine Corps dog trainer. And I was like, I need to, I never tested myself. Like, I'm too soft. I need to start boxing. I need to box Laura Vandenberg, get my ass kicked. Find some humility and some toughness. I need to do, CrossFit? I need to join a fitness club. I need to join the SEALs. I need to go through Navy SEAL training. Just see if I can I make it? Because it's not the guys that are super ripped, you know, right? Isn't that what they say? Like, if you look at the picture of the Navy SEALs, a lot of them are kind of schlubby. They just can tolerate insane abuse, like physical and mental abuse. They don't fold. Like 99% of people can't make it? Maybe I could. I do have a high pain tolerance. Like physical pain. I don't know about like mental pain or like psychological pain. So, anyway, long day, long Saturday, long week, long 3 weeks, long 2 years, long life, long presidency, long experience. Nothing lasts. That's nice to think about. In some respects, that's also awful to think about. I feel like I should have a cup of coffee or something, even though it's nighttime. I feel like I should sleep. I'm gonna go to bed.